Hi, I'm Andrea Loyan, Vermont Edition producer, and I just wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening, and enjoy!
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Vermont's legislative session is somehow already halfway done. Friday marked a big milestone. It was crossover day, the day that determines whether many bills continue on their way toward becoming law. Today on the show, we're going to be joined by a panel of reporters to talk us through the bills that have made it this far and the ones that have been left aside. But first, here to give us an inside look at the State House so far is House Speaker Jill Krawinski, a Democrat. She represents Burlington residents in her Chittenden 16 House seat. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And listeners, you can join the conversation as well this Monday. What questions do you have for Speaker Krawinski about the legislature's actions? Give us a call. Our number is 800-639-2211. You can also send us an email to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Now, Speaker Krawinski, the last time we had you on Vermont Edition, it was the first day of the legislative session, and we were broadcasting live from the State House. And Democrats were coming into the session in a really good place. They have a veto-proof majority. And on that first day of the session, you said, I'm quoting here, "While we do have a historic majority of Democrats in the House, 104, we build coalitions around bills to have tripartisan support." So before we get to more contentious points from the session so far, what's one example of that tripartisan work that has been successful in this session so far?
Oh, that's a great question, Michaela. And I have to say, that conversation feels like 2 years ago.
I know. It really does.
at this point. So one example of this, I want to say it's a bill that hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but it's really critical for consumer protection. We have a data privacy bill. It's a really technical and complex bill, but it's a huge step in protecting Vermonters' information, especially for our younger and older Vermonters who are targeted online. And so this bill hasn't come to the floor yet, but it has potential to be one of the strongest data consumer protections bill in this country. And again, it came out of committee on a unanimous vote. I'll say on Friday, we had a board up in our office that keeps track of all the bills that need to pass. And a majority of the bills on that board had unanimous or near unanimous votes. So I could use this entire time to talk through all those different bills. But I'm really proud of the teamwork that's been happening to move bills through the process. Bills that really improve the life for all Vermonters and all 14 counties.
Mm. Well, I'm glad we could start with that because unfortunately we can't linger on the teamwork aspect so far, though I'm sure it'll come up again in the conversation. I do want to dive into one of the more contentious topics in Montpelier right now, which is the Budget Adjustment Act. It essentially updates the larger budget that was approved last year, and it was reluctantly signed by Governor Phil Scott last week. He said, essentially, that it exceeded his budget proposal by $15 million, which could create a pretty significant budget gap for FY25. What do you think of his concerns?
Well, look, we know that we're coming into this legislative session coming in a different spot with where we are with the federal funds that we got during COVID. So as all Vermonters know, we were so fortunate to get this huge influx of money from Washington to help us through the crisis. And so now we are coming back into this session with most of those dollars already accounted for or being spent. There's a little left, but we're basically resetting our budget from where we were before COVID. We have some really incredible opportunities, but also challenges and how we navigate this new landscape. I'm proud of the work that we did, the investments in the budget adjustment, and now we are focused on the budget. And that's true. We are starting the budget $15 million in the red. But we have a committee process that will get us back to zero and then look at, okay, what are the priorities that we are hearing from Vermonters across the state? How do we want to invest in how housing? How do we want to invest in climate? What about healthcare, public safety? These are themes that we hear from all corners of the state. So we're going to need to work together, sit around the table, roll up our sleeves, and figure out do we need to raise revenue to cover the cost of these priorities that people have, or do we need to look for savings or understand what other one-time money we have on the table? So that's what's happening this week and next week, are really tough, important, critical conversations on how we line up what those priorities are and how they are paid for.
Well, raising revenue essentially means increasing taxes. Can you talk us through a couple of the potential new revenue streams that you think, as House Speaker, hold promise?
Well, I think I heard this at the top of the show, that, and I want to be clear and reiterate it again, that if we go down the path of raising revenue, we're going to be asking corporations or the wealthy to pay their fair share. Hard stop. So there are a number of different taxes that we have looked at in the past. One of those are the cloud tax that has come up. We've passed that multiple times. That's one example. I think for those who are really interested in this conversation, our House Ways and Means Committee are going to be really doing the deep dive and work this week to look at it. And so, again, I just want to reiterate that we're going to be focused on corporations and the wealthy to pay their fair share.
When you say pay their fair share, does that mean that you wouldn't be raising taxes on lower and middle income Vermonters, or is that still a possibility?
When I talk about how we want to approach raising revenue, I have been clear that we really need to have it focused on big corporations and on the wealthy. That is where we need to look. It is so important. I know I talk to Vermonters every day as I go and I travel around, and I know that there's this fear and this need that we need more housing. Healthcare costs are going up. How can you help us? And I hear that. I deeply hear that and appreciate it. I'm there too. So again, our focus will be on corporations and the wealthy to pay their fair share.
Well, let's talk housing, since you just brought it up. Governor Phil Scott last week had some pretty strong words for the legislature for not making more progress, in his view, on housing development and Act 250 reform efforts. He essentially said that the government doesn't have the money to fund all the residential building projects that the state needs to meet the demand for housing. And here's what he went on to say.
At the beginning of the session, I stood here with a tripartisan group of lawmakers to outline a package of common sense but impactful regulatory reforms and incentives that would help increase housing rehabilitation and construction across the state. To date, that bill has received no attention in the House, despite the efforts of members like Rep. Bartley and Rep. Elder, who are here with us today. The Senate Economic Development Committee moved forward with the Be Home bill, which has been stuck in the Senate Natural Resources for weeks with no discussion.
House Speaker Jill Krawinski, you've said that there are actually numerous bills in the works to address this issue around housing. I'd like to hear your thoughts on Governor Scott's statement and also more about these bills.
Sure. So I really don't think Vermonters care about what the bill number is or who sponsored it when it comes to any of these incredible important issues like housing. They want to know that the contents of that legislation will make a difference for them. So we have three bills moving through the process that will address affordable housing. So the first one is a bill that creates a 10-year roadmap for affordable housing and rehabilitation of housing for Vermonters of all walks of life. The second sets housing goals and includes accountability and flood notification. And then the third is our Act 250 land use modernization bill. Components of the legislation that the governor mentioned are sprinkled throughout some of these bills, not all of it. But I'm really proud of the work that we are doing to just be laser focused on housing, since that is, again, such a critical issue that we hear about from so many Vermonters.
Well, let's go to the phones. We have a couple calls coming in. Robert in Bethel is on the line. Robert, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, Michaela. Hey, Joe. How are you?
Doing well. What's your comment or question?
The comment is, well, I'll make it simple, the third rail, the elephant in the room, housing and education. And people cannot afford to move to Vermont, and the reason why they're leaving Vermont is 85% of their property taxes goes to the 54 supervisory unions. So I would recommend to Jill to have a conversation with the governor and say, hey, listen, Gov, we need to reduce our supervisory unions because there's no children in the schools. I mean, it's killing Vermonters. So Jill's concerned about housing. Well, in about 10 years, there'll be no need for housing because people are leaving here, and people will not bring their children here because the school system is a disaster.
Well, Robert, thank you so much for your call. I'd like House Speaker Jill Krawinski to respond. And for our listeners, of course, Robert is referring to the fact that school funding has been a huge topic in the past couple of months. As we know, about a third of school budgets failed to pass on town meeting day. Some districts postponed their votes and haven't voted yet. But, you know, a lot of Vermonters are struggling to stomach new taxes when we saw this major repudiation of proposed property tax hikes on town meeting day.
Right. Thanks, Robert, for the question. And trust me, I have talked to the governor about this. I mean,
do you call him Gov?
did I say
that? No, the caller did.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. So, well, I do call him governor. And this is the perfect storm that we have here. What school boards were facing as they were putting their budgets together, right, is the end of federal funding that was helping schools get through COVID, rising health care costs. We're looking at greater needs for students. And all of these things are just are coming together at the same time that's putting all this pressure on it. And it's a problem. We hear it and we're working on it. We passed a short-term bill to help address this that gave school boards the opportunity to pull those budgets back and look for further savings or delay certain things. You know that several school boards took advantage of that. We don't have all the data back because not all the school budgets have been voted on. So when we have a better picture of what we're looking at and we have the data, we can really hit the road running on the rest of the possible solutions to tackle this problem. We're having conversations about school construction, for example. We know that deferred maintenance has been a big issue. That's something that maybe the state can come back in and play a greater role in. Community schools is another strategy that we've been using to help address student needs and make sure that we're finding ways for partnerships and collaborations. I know that we will have to look at some revenue to help with the Ed Fund, but I want Vermonters to know that we are working on addressing the challenges, and we hear you.
Mm. Let's take one more call for House Speaker Jill Krawinski while we have her. John in Waterford is on the line. John, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to hit on one point when you said you were going to raise taxes on corporations. When you raise the taxes on corporations, they simply pass that cost on to the consumer, and it becomes a hidden tax on consumers. Corporations don't eat that tax. They simply pass it on in the goods and services that they provide. If you want to really raise revenue, lower taxes and spur economic activity, and ultimately you'll raise revenue that way. But taxing something only means you get less of it. So taxing corporations is an economic down spiral. I wonder if you could address that.
Well, thank you for your comment, John. And again, lots of conversations about proposed tax hikes on all different groups going on in Ways and Means right now. But Speaker Krawinski, any thoughts for John there?
John, I appreciate your call. And I'll say I think we have different philosophies on this. I think that there is capacity for taxing with some of the big corporations out there. And I would say, you know, I welcome people to join us in this conversation about what levers we have available to have the least amount of impact when it comes to raising taxes on working Vermonters. We do not want to increase taxes on working Vermonters. We're focused on corporations and the wealthy. And so happy to continue these types of conversations as we dig into the details this week in the building.
Well, thank you, John, for the call. Let's wrap up Speaker Kerwinski with one more example of some a bill that has attracted broad support across the aisles. A healthcare-related bill passed the House unanimously last week, H 766. Can you tell us about the patient protections that are in it and why you think it has such broad support?
Well, Michaela, this has been a long time coming. You know, our providers face excessive paperwork. It leads to burnout. It distracts them from their ability to focus on patients. So we passed House Bill 766, which removes barriers with prior authorization. And that means that there will be more access to healthcare for Vermonters and for healthcare providers to have more time with their patients and less time with insurance companies. And so this was, I have to say, a really incredible moment on the House floor when everybody was shaking their head, yes, this is critical to our healthcare system at a time when it's really hard for us to look at what other opportunities we have to increase access to healthcare and lower cost. This was a no-brainer. And so it was a really good debate, and I'm looking forward to the Senate taking that up and getting it to the governor.
All right. Well, yes, lots more to come in this legislative session. House Speaker Jill Kerwinski, thanks so much for joining us and talking us through what's gone down so far.
Thanks so much.
Today on the show, we are looking at what bills made it through crossover day, what bills failed, and the general tenor of this year's session. We are now joined by a trio of State House reporters. They've been closely tracking key bills as they move through the legislature. With me in the studio is Abigail Giles, Vermont Public's climate and environment reporter. Abigail, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Michaela.
Yeah, it's good to see you. And in Montpelier, my colleague Bob Kinzel is a senior political reporter. Bob, how are you doing?
Doing great.
And with him is Sarah Meerhoff, the State House Bureau Chief for VT Digger. Sarah, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and if you have questions about the bills that are moving their way through this legislative session, give us a call. 800-639-2211 is our number. Bob, start us off with the basics of crossover day. What exactly does it mark?
Well, what it says basically is that a bill has to be out of its committee of jurisdiction by the crossover deadline. So that's the first committee that it goes out of. Now, if it has to go to the Ways and Means Committee because there are revenue considerations or there might be some budget considerations, then it can go to the appropriations committees. So they have another week to work through that process. But it's a way of starting to say, okay, this is going to make it. This one, maybe not. Now, there's sort of an addendum here, which is if there's a bill that didn't make it, it is possible for a member to try to add it to another bill that's under consideration in the next couple of months. So for the most part, bills that don't make it are going to be dead. But there is a lifeline if people want to use it.
There's some grafting to be done. Now, Abigail, I know you've been spending a lot of time at the State House this session, and I remember you and I chatting on the first day of the session, and the energy and the hopes were running so high. What's the tenor like now?
Yeah, Michaela, I think, like Bob said, we're kind of getting to this time in the session where it's sort of like the rubber hits the road. Mm-hmm. And I know certainly in following climate environment bills in the building, the big ones that I've been looking at have certainly been moving. I think that there's kind of continued energy around looking at ways to address some of the impacts of climate change that we've seen as a state in the last year. So both around looking at ways to kind of try to make Vermont communities and Vermonters a little bit closer to whole after the flooding this summer. And then also looking ahead both at reducing our emissions as a state and at ways to hopefully, I think, lawmakers want to try to make us better prepared for that next climate disaster.
Yeah, well, we'll dive into all of those in just a moment. But first, Sarah, I know it can be pretty tense to watch lawmakers watch a bill that they've been working on die or be turned into, you know, a summer study, something like that. Any notable examples that you've seen of tensions running high in these past few kind of intense weeks?
I think that the tensest conversation happening in the building right now is Act 250, the 50-year-old land use bill. In Vermont, the tensions between Governor Scott and the legislature, I would say, and Bob, I'd be really interested to hear if you agree with this. I feel like they're at an all-time high around this issue specifically. It feels like every week the governor, when he has his weekly press conferences on Wednesdays, he gets up and is taking shots at the legislature for not doing what he says is a really high need, big time reform to this long time land use law. And the legislature is they are working on Act 250 bills. Abigail, I know that you are also an expert on this, but I think the governor would say that they're just not doing enough and they're not doing it fast enough. And the tensions are incredibly palpable on this one, I think.
Yeah, I'd love to hear both of your thoughts here. Bob, let's start with you. Do you agree with Sarah that this is kind of an all-time high point for tension around Act 250?
And it's been an ongoing tension, too. You know, this is not a new issue for the legislature to deal with. They've been dealing for this for years. People thought, well, maybe this is the year that there will be some consensus on how to do this, and it's starting to unravel. I think it's also spreading to other issues as well. Now, you can always say, of course, there's always a tension between the legislative branch of government and the executive branch. Each branch wants to take its own direction on a particular issue. But things feel a little tense up there right now. And maybe that's just part of the process, and we have to get through these bills in the next couple of weeks. The action on the House floor and the Senate floor will just be continuous for the next 2 weeks as many of these bills come out of committee and get up for consideration. But there are a number of issues like Act 250 that, if they don't get resolved, have the ability and the potential to sort of turning everything sideways. And that's something to keep an eye on.
Abigail, how have you been seeing this play out?
Yeah, I think, Sarah and Bob are spot on. It definitely feels like there are tensions are high around some of these issues. I think jumping back a little bit to Act 250, I'll be really curious to see what happens in the Senate Natural Resources and Energy Committee. I know that's a committee where some senior lawmakers have really expressed that they have grave concerns about, rolling back some of the protections for land use around Act 250 to support housing. And so I think we'll see a lot of this kind of tension mount as those bills make their way to that committee this session.
Well, you could call in and join our conversation at 800-639-2211. We have a question from Bob in Rutland. Bob, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I was going to say, I'm just calling about open meeting legislation. I know in the Senate there was S-55, so that helped Vermonters to begin to have open meetings again and participate in the process for the legislature rather than just letting bills be passed remotely. So I'd like your comments. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob. Sarah, let's take a brief detour towards this open meeting legislation, S-55. Is this something that you followed? Do you know where it stands?
I haven't been following this specific bill super closely, but I will say that I think that the legislature is at this interesting inflection point when it comes to open meeting rules and where we go from here post-COVID. I think that COVID was a real reset on this front, and we had to really radically shift our understanding of what is open access. Does that mean in person and getting to shake people's hands and, be in the room and witnessing meetings? Or is it truly more democratic and more accessible if we have live streamed and virtual meetings? And I think we also had to shift our understanding of openness and accessibility for lawmakers themselves. I mean, it was not long ago that lawmakers could not vote if they were sick or taking care of their children, for instance, if they needed to work remotely for the day, like so many folks do nowadays. So I think this is a real area where we kind of have almost one foot in and one foot out, it feels like, and we're trying to strike that balance.
And we just looked up S-55. It looks like it's still in committee in the Senate. But Bob, thanks so much for bringing that issue to light. We'll look into it for you as well. Let's turn for a moment to the budget as well as money bills. Now, Bob, another bit of legislative logistics for you. There's a kind of second crossover deadline this Friday for so-called money bills. What should we know there? How does that work?
So you've got a lot of bills that in one way or another might affect the tax revenue base of the state, might need to have an appropriation attached to it, could be small, could be large, but still needs to be looked at by the appropriations committees. So they're, you know, right now, this is going to be a crazy week for them because there's going to be lots of action on the floor in both the House and the Senate. And yet both the Ways and Means Committee and the Finance Committee in the Senate and the Appropriations Committees in the House and Senate are going to have to be in their committee rooms considering a lot of these bills that are going to come up, and then the bells will ring and they'll be told if there's going to be a roll call vote or a vote on a particular issue. So it's a very important time for these bills. And, you know, there's not a lot of extra money. And this is where I think there's going to be a lot of tension in the next couple of weeks. There are going to be some lawmakers who feel that the state budget should be increased. Now, there are about $250 million in possible requests. That's probably not going to happen. But you could see something like $50 or $75 million in additional requests, things like more staff for the criminal justice system, mental health programs, nursing home care for low-income folks. There's some very pent-up demand. And if they do decide to add these to the budget in the House, the question will be, how do we pay for it? And you just heard the speaker say, we're not going to raise taxes on working people if we decide to raise taxes, but we could raise taxes on the wealthy or on corporations. So all of this could be in play. And then the governor is going to say, no, we're not raising taxes. Whatever we do, if you want to add money to this budget, you go right ahead and do that, but then subtract something. And so I think he's made it pretty clear that any kind of tax increase that comes up in the House, and that's where a tax increase would have to come first procedurally, he's going to veto it. And then it's going to come back to, is there going to be a veto override, which takes 2/3, which is a lot of people. So there's a lot of some budgetary issues that need to play out in the next couple of weeks.
Mm. And Sarah, what do you think? Do you think that the coalition is strong enough to have a veto override?
I would say that it would depend on every individual bill, but I would say on the issue
we're talking about taxes, yes,
right. On raising revenues, I think that the House is they've got a pretty strong caucus on issues like this and pretty good whipping power on things like this. And I think that that would be – it's hard to say without a bill right in front of me and with so much still up in the air. But I think this is an issue where I can see there being a strong enough coalition on something like that.
Mm. Well, and, you know, Michaela, it may also come down to does House Democratic leaders – do they identify certain programs – with this tax increase. So if they say, okay, well, we want to increase taxes by $50 million, and here's where we want to spend it, and the governor vetoes it, and let's just say for the sake of discussion, they are unable to override, they can come back in the fall, it is an election year, and say, guess what? We don't have these programs, and we don't have them because of Phil Scott. And we don't know who – we don't know if Phil Scott is going to be running again. I think the indications are that he probably will be. We don't know who the Democratic challenger or progressive challenger might be. So all this can kind of get filtered into campaign issues and election issues, and that's also sort of an extra tension that's on board as we consider these in the next couple of weeks.
Ooh. I would also just jump in and add that that's a great point, Bob, and it's also really – the messaging is stronger for any increase in revenues or increase in taxes if you inherently tie it to a program and to be able to both in the chamber and to your voters to say, we are doing this to raise money for XYZ. That's a lot, you know, more palpable for folks as opposed to we are raising money, quote unquote, taxing the rich or whatever any of these tax initiatives may be for the sake of taxation. That isn't a super great talking point.
Yeah, we saw typically that last year with the big bill to address the issues around early childhood education and affordability and access. Abigail, I'd like to take a turn towards some specific climate legislation, but sort of on the same theme of things that Democrats and Governor Scott might not agree on. Let's start with the renewable energy standard. It's moved forward. It would essentially require Vermont utilities to purchase 100% of their power from renewable sources by 2032 rather than just 75%. Governor Scott says, you know, he likes the idea of it, but if this is going to make fuel more expensive for Vermonters, that's going to be a no for him. Did I summarize that correctly? Tell us more about where this stands.
Yeah, absolutely, Michaela. So the bill takes, for the biggest utilities in the state, the deadline is 2030 to be 100% renewable. And then it gives kind of a longer on-ramp for municipal utilities. That they'd have until 2035. And I think one of the really interesting provisions in this bill is that there's a new requirement essentially for purchasing new regional renewables. So also the bill would double the amount of, new in-state renewables that utilities have to invest in. And I think, you know, in the sort of emission space, you know, people in a lot of the environmental groups in the state are saying, you know, it's those new renewables that offset the fossil fuel dependency that we see in our regional grid. So Vermont utilities may be making, you know, X amount of progress with their portfolios, but we're connected to the same grid as all the other New England states. And so with that bill, it's headed to the House floor this week. And I think, you know, earlier when we last spoke about this, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty around the numbers. So I think a natural question is, you know, what would this cost Vermonters to try to really lower emissions in the electric sector in this way? And I think here you see this real tension between people who are saying, you know, we need to, as we electrify things like transportation and home heat, make our power as clean as possible to, you know, mitigate the impacts of climate change. And then people who are asking, you know, we have all these challenges around affordability. What is Vermonters' sort of fair share? Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of like the core tension. We saw some really big numbers put out by the Scott administration earlier this year in terms of what this might cost. And actually, the Joint Fiscal Office, legislative analysts have put out a second analysis that essentially puts the sort of high end of this at about $450 million by 2035, potentially as low as $150 million. And I think, you know, previously we'd heard as high as $1 billion. And I think what you're seeing there is that there is some real unknown, in part because of what it might cost to upgrade our transmission and distribution systems, so the like grid itself. We're going to have to do a lot of that anyway as we transition towards more renewables and cleaner energy as people electrify. But I think that there's just a lot of uncertainty about how much, you know, more renewables might cost in that context. And I think you're really seeing this sort of tension. Nobody really knows, but you've got the administration saying, hey, we're really worried about ratepayers, and you see environmental groups and also the development community saying we really need this new renewable power now. And I think, you know, lawmakers are trying to sort of sort out, like, what is the sort of right balance there? But importantly, I think that we've really heard from legislative analysts that we still don't know how much this would cost, but it's going to be most likely a lot less than what the Scott administration had initially forecast.
Mm. And forgive me, you said briefly where this bill stands right now. What's its status?
Yeah, it's headed to the House floor this week. And so, you know, I think with a lot of these kind of energy and climate policies, lawmakers are kind of in a tricky position because we don't know exactly how much everything is going to cost before they have to make a decision. They use the best tools available to them. And that's kind of where this one sits.
Our guests are VT Digger State House Bureau Chief Sarah Meerhoff, Vermont Public Climate Reporter Abigail Giles, and Vermont Public Senior Reporter Bob Kinzel. Bob, I thought all that construction was done at the Capitol Plaza Hotel in Montpelier. What's going on?
Oh, no, they're coming down the home stretch here. I think they're hoping to have part of the facility open in about 3 or 4 weeks, but you will hear construction sounds. Just outside our door, there's a lot of drilling going on, so apologize for that, but it's really out of our control.
No problem at all. Well, that actually reminds me that we should talk about flood recovery. Of course, the hotel that you are all in right now, where our studio is there in Montpelier, was damaged during the July floods. And, you know, at the start of the legislative session, the buzz for all the bills that go in. All the conversations there was about flood recovery, how to help Vermonters who were affected by the floods last year, and how to make the state more resilient. I'm guessing all three of you have been following different aspects of this. Bob, let's start with you. What have you been keeping an eye on?
I think I should punt here to sure. either Abigail or Sarah, who have been covering this much more closely than I have.
All right, you've been covering the updates on the hotel itself, on the ground efforts there.
And what's happening with the state buildings? We're going to have a lot of construction of floodproof the state buildings coming up in the next 6 months or 12 months.
All right. Well, Abigail, let's go to you next. What have you been focusing on? S-723 is one of the big ones, right? Big omnibus flood recovery bill that stalled. What else is going on?
Yeah. So there's, kind of like two pools, I would say. There's their efforts in the building to try to set aside more money for municipalities and for individuals and businesses who might need, still financial recovery after the flooding in July. But then there's also this kind of eye to the future about, okay, how can we leverage our landscape and our regulatory tools to try to make Vermont towns and communities better prepared for the next flood? So there's one big bill called the Flood Safety Act that just passed out of Senate Appropriations late last week, headed to the floor this week. And essentially, it takes a look at, bolstering support for making sure dams are safe. It also looks at really expanding our protection of wetlands in Vermont because they slow down floodwaters. And I think the most interesting part of the bill is it proposes a statewide program to regulate new development in river corridors. So these are the places where the river moves within its natural landscape, often where buildings get swept away. Lawmakers really want to say, hey, we need to stop developing in this space. So that bill, I think there's some questions about how much funding might be available in the first years for that programming. We'll see what happens later in the session, but it definitely had some strong support in terms of environmental advocates and certainly Democratic and I think bipartisan, lawmakers in the building. Another interesting thing there, Michaela, is there is a bill, the Climate Superfund Act, that tries to sort of look at this question of funding. Certainly I think some lawmakers are saying, hey, climate change is really expensive. This flood cost us at least $1 billion last summer. That was one event. Who should pay for this work to make us more resilient, to make us whole? Vermonters, working people didn't cause this crisis that we're in. And so I think there's another bill that endeavors to look at ways we can kind of recoup cost from big oil companies to try to pay for that work. It's called the Climate Superfund Act, and interestingly, it moved out of its committee of jurisdiction late last week with bipartisan support, unanimous support, and the Scott administration has said it supports the idea as well.
Mm. Any lasting concerns about like whether something like that could lead to court action, which could cost a lot of money for the state?
Yeah, I think that is a really interesting question. We would be potentially the first state in the country to do something right. like this. There is a federal bill, but it's not moving anywhere anytime fast. The Attorney General has said she's willing to go to court for Vermont on this issue. I think there are some questions, as I understand it, about constitutionality that could be a place where, these big polluters come and try to sort of take on something like this in the future. But yeah, talking to lawyers, they really say the case for this sort of an approach is really robust. We have a lot of case law in our country that shows that this idea of making big polluters pay for the pollution they created is something that the courts have supported, that the laws have supported. And so I think that there are questions about how long that would take. But, we're talking potentially about really big sums of money here. And climate change is going to cost the state billions. We know that. We don't know how much. But I think that there's a lot of interest in trying to make sure it's not Vermonters who shoulder that cost on their own.
Right. Well, let's pivot here for a moment, Sarah. I know you've been following a number of flood recovery bills as well, but so many topics to hit on coming out of crossover day. One of which you mentioned at the top of the show, a flavored tobacco ban. Have you been following this?
Yeah, it's a really interesting debate. This bill, S-18, it passed out of the House this week, though notably not by a veto-proof majority. This would ban, exactly as it sounds, flavored tobacco products, including menthol and mint-flavored, which is a pretty contentious point, actually, in this bill. The intent of it is to prevent kids from taking up, nicotine-addictive habits. I think we've all seen kids with their vape pens, and then there are also different kind of chewing tobacco products that have all of these different flavors. And there is a debate over whether these flavored products encourage or almost court children to use them, and then of course hook kids from a young age, and they almost can become lifers in that way. And so this is a public health debate. And also there are some folks who say, no, we should, let adults do what they want to do. And if kids take up substances that they shouldn't be anyway, then that's a separate almost enforcement issue on children and their ability to access these substances that they shouldn't be able to buy from, say, the gas station or whatever. It's a hot debate, and I'm very interested to see what the governor does on this one. My sense from when we've asked him about it is that he may veto it, though I've been surprised by him before, of course. So I'm very, very intrigued by this one. There's also a question over the revenue impact of something like this. If these products cannot be sold, and nicotine products have very high taxes, the money losses that could result from banning these products. So a lot up in the air with this one. It's a fascinating bill.
And Bob, I know you've been following that one as well, but I do want to switch from tobacco over to cannabis. There's a couple bills about the cannabis program right now. Can you talk us through what's going on there?
Sure. The main part of the cannabis bill addresses the future of the medical cannabis program. That's been in existence in Vermont for 15 years, and there's been a real decline in the number of patients in that program since the advent of the legal retail market back in October of 2022. The number of patients is actually been cut in half, from about 5,000 down to 2,500. And so the concern is, if some of the existing medical dispensaries close because they have a lack of business, where are these patients going to go? Just geographically, they're going to have long, long drives. And I should say that the patients in the medical program are able to access THC products that are more potent than the ones that are available in retail stores, and they also don't have to pay the 20% tax. So the idea is, how does the state save the medical cannabis program? And the way that the bill does it is to allow certain retail stores, some of them, if they can qualify, to become and have what they call a medical endorsement. And so a retail store would be able to sell products to the medical patients, not charge them the 20% tax, also have those specialty products available. And that's really the major part of the bill. Now, part of the bill also begins to address this whole zoning question of growers in densely populated areas, the famous Essex Junction case with the ducks, where neighbors were unhappy with the ducks, they were unhappy with the cannabis, they were unhappy with the smell of manure. And so it begins to raise that as an issue for communities to discuss it and to have votes on it. Now, it's also interesting what this bill does not do that some proponents want. It does not eliminate the THC potency caps on products available in retail stores right now. There's a 30% cap on flower product and a 60% cap on concentrates. And there was a big push from a lot of growers, let's get rid of these caps. Vermont's one of the very few states to have these caps. And it was actually eliminating the caps was supported by the Cannabis Control Board. But it's strongly opposed by the Vermont Medical Society. And sponsors of the bill felt, well, this is a fight for another day. We want to get this medical program through this year. We'll deal with the caps next year. The bill also does not allow growers to sell directly to consumers. That's another thing that a lot of growers want to be able to do. Hey, if you can sell your corn and tomatoes, why can't you sell your cannabis? Again, sponsors of the bill said, very good issue, should be considered in the future, but let's not wrap it into this bill. So that's where that one stands now.
Interesting. And if you want to dive a little bit deeper into some of this conversation, we had a recent very interesting episode of Vermont Edition with the head of the Cannabis Control Board, James Pepper, from just a few weeks back that you can check out as well. Now, briefly here, we got a call earlier from a listener named Eileen who wasn't able to stay on the line, but they wanted to know about the possible changes to Fish and Wildlife, Vermont Fish and Wildlife. And Abigail, I know you've been following this one. Can you tell us about what's on the table?
Yeah, so there is a bill in the Senate. It goes to the floor this week. Essentially, it would ban the hunting of coyotes with hounds in Vermont, and it includes some new setbacks for traps from trails. But the biggest thing that I think has been really controversial, Michaela, is that it proposes restructuring the Fish and Wildlife Board and changing the powers of the board. So this is a board that has actually had the authority to write regulations that govern hunting and fishing and trapping in the state. It has traditionally been made up of appointed members who are hunters and anglers and trappers. And what this law proposes, or this bill proposes, I should say, is to require that the board be split 50% between people who engage in those activities and people who don't. Huh. And it's been really, really controversial. So I think it went through appropriations last week, and I heard there from some Republican members that they are going to be introducing an amendment on the floor that would substantially change the bill. So I think we'll have to see this week. And this one's a tricky one. You know, I think even Democrats in the Northeast Kingdom, for example, are in a position where I'm sure it's tricky because I think a lot of their constituents have concerns about this change.
Yeah. Well, fascinating. We'll be interested to hear where that goes next. We have about 20 seconds left. And Sarah, I'm just going to toss this one to you. A bill that died that you were surprised by or that you were enjoyed following that you're going to miss.
Oh, boy. I really intentionally do not grow emotional attachments to any bill.
Wise.
Michaela, for that very reason.
All right. Well, rest in peace to all that did not make it through this session, though I'm sure some of them will revive themselves later on this session or in a future one. It's been so fascinating hearing about all that's going on at the State House in Montpelier with Bob Kinzel, Sarah Meerhoff, and Abigail Giles. Thanks to all of you. This was great.
Thank you, Michaela.
Thanks.
Thanks.